Okay. We only have 20 minutes left. Is that what you said? Okay. Well, then let me rush through the rest of my presentation. As I was actually discussing informally with a few of you during the break, really I think what I'm saying here is I'm going back to sort of a kind of anthropology of religion or a psychology of religion that says that really love is what we come into the world looking for. We come into this world expecting it. And human beings seem to never be fulfilled by it. Life can be defined as a series of disappointments along the way. Either a sibling didn't handle us very well, we expected to be loved by a sibling and they failed us. My uncle, abused me. Or, who knows? There's always so many disappointments in love. So I think we keep, it's the most important thing to us, but yet it's the thing that we tend to avoid because we're scared of it. We don't know how to access it. And we're scared of disappointment. I see this happening in religion. I think that in religion we also avoid love, even when it's so powerfully there. Jesus is certainly a very, very powerful expression of divine love, ultimate love. It may not be for you, it may not be for me, but it certainly is for 3 billion people. But I'm not sure it is for them in terms of love. I think it may be other comfort issues coming up. I think it may be protecting them from sin. It may be, again, too utilitarian. And maybe we come to religion that way. So basically, I'm a specialist in Indic traditions. So I've been looking for these deep symbols of love in Indic traditions. And so I've come out with this book, as Ferdinando mentioned, A Dance of Divine Love, which is a translation, really, of... good. How about that? There we go. The book is not that large, as you can see. It's really quite compact. But this is a blow-up, a little washed out, but it can do the job. But it looks much nicer on your screen, Fernando. What happened to the...
That's the other one. It was
that is very
file,
washed
that's
out.
That's the one I could open.
Yeah, okay, okay. Well, thank you. So basically, what I examine here is a love story. Actually, why don't we go down... let's skip the 10 theses right now. Let's go right there. Good. Okay, good. We got both of us. Okay. Basically, in this very theistic tradition, there is these Vaishnava traditions that Rudolf Otto himself focused upon, I also have been looking at for years. And in particular, the Chaitanya school of Vaishnavism that originated out of Bengal and spread up throughout the northern part of India recognized that that intimacy with divinity is something very tangible and very positive and very important. And this also is concurred in many Western mystical traditions as well. And so it's a fascinating study. But I particularly am interested in this tradition because I've never seen it defined so thoroughly and deeply, this idea of how love can manifest in the individual heart toward the divine heart. The five relationships of love I've put here, and these are my own sort of definitions. I talk about these in some depth within this book. Reverential love, where one's love for divinity is very grand. It's a love. It's a little bit like my love for Michael Jordan. Wait a minute. We're in Sweden now. Okay. So Michael Jordan is a basketball player. Was it a football player? So you all know. Okay, good. So this is obviously just an example because obviously I'm not a sports kind of guy, But anyway, if I did have this love for Michael Jordan, it's I just think he's fantastic. He's greater. He's bigger than life itself. I have love for him, but he doesn't even know me. I mean, he doesn't know me. It's not interactive. It's a passive. It's a more passive relationship. But then the other relationships are active. The reverential love. I give the example of subjects with an emperor. An emperor does a lot for his subjects just by being a protective and wonderful emperor, but the subjects serve the emperor out of love. But subservient love would be, say, a king. It's not maybe as grand as an emperor. A king with his ministers. And the ministers and the king, there's an interactive relationship, but it's definitely one of the king being in a superior position and the ministers being in a subservient position. Then mutual love, friendship. Now, from 3 to 5, this is where really the intimacy with divinity is profoundly presented in this tradition in very marvelous ways. It gets more when you go from 1 to 5, the intensity of love increases, and the intimacy within love increases, all the way to the point of a kind of parental relationship, a nurturing love, caring relationship, where even the devotee becomes in a superior position to the divinity. Sometimes you can even see this a little bit in Christianity, where the adorable Jesus, the baby Jesus, they have that hymn, "O come, let us adore him." I mean, this is sort of Vatsalya Bhava. And then passionate love, the lover-beloved kind of relationship in which the ultimate intensity of intimacy and love occurs. The poem that I translate here, the Rasa-lila, known as the Rasa-lila, is 176 verses from a much greater text of 335 chapters, collectively known as the Bhagavata Purana. It is one of the most loved texts of all of India. It's written in Sanskrit, in absolutely beautiful Sanskrit. In fact, that's how this began. I wasn't intending to, at Harvard, I actually wasn't planning to do this for a dissertation. I was planning to do a comparative dissertation, because that is, after all, what my studies were all about. But it came out that really there wasn't enough work done on the Indic tradition to even conduct, sound comparative work. So my advisor sort of guided me to this text. And it is a five-chapter, or what I call five acts, sort of a divine drama between Krishna and the Vrajagopikas, the cowherd maidens of Vraja, in this kind of idealistic paradisial setting known as Vraj. And it's really sort of the Indian sort of counterpart to the Song of Solomon. The main difference of which, of course there are many differences, but the main difference of which would be that this is very deliberately a sacred love story. It is a love story between the divinity and the devotee. In the Song of Solomon, it has to be taken allegorically to be considered as such. And of course, as many of you may know, there's all kinds of fuss whether the Song of Solomon should even be in the Bible at all. It's annoyed rabbis for centuries that it's even there, and they kind of skip over it because it's a rather passionate, even erotic text. And yet other rabbis, more mystical rabbis, say that it's the essence of the Bible. It is the essence. The rest of the Bible's commentary. That I'm thinking of Rabbi Akiva in particular. So this sacred love story in the Sanskrit has never received this level of treatment in scholarship, and so I tried to bring it out, and it took me an awful long time, but I eventually got there. The Sanskrit's very difficult Sanskrit, but it is beautiful Sanskrit. My teacher at Harvard in Sanskrit said that it was the most enchanting poem ever written. The most enchanting poem ever written. Those are strong words. In fact, you're not used to hearing such absolutistic judgments in the academy, and Daniel Ingalls was not one for making such statements, but I was very curious to know what was so beautiful about it. And so I looked at it not only as a piece of theology, but as a piece of literature. And I look at the interaction of both. So, and finally, in examining this, what turned out to be, and I understand why he, a little bit of why he said that, it is an absolutely exquisitely beautiful piece of Sanskrit. It is just, I don't know 14 languages the way Daniel Ingalls did, so I'm in no position to tell you, yes, it is definitely the most enchanting poem ever written, but I can say from my sort of specialized knowledge that it definitely deserves a place in the most beautiful and most powerful love sacred love poems of the world. It belongs in that list. These are eight phases of love that I extracted, discerned in examining this text. And, you know, I think that you can use these in understanding, for example, the Song of Solomon. I think you can see these kinds of phases occurring in even the life of Jesus. Devastating loss being the resurrection. The crucifixion of Jesus, and then the resurrection, right? And then, in other words, I think that these phases are universal. I think that these are the, and they aren't necessarily in this order. They're often in this order, but they can be revisited and sort of flip-flopped revisited again in a text. So they're not strict categories, but they're phases that can be mixed and matched. And frankly, they can be phases in love as we know it. In our relationships, we sometimes feel a great separation and conflict. And in any love relationship, there are these phases. I think that what human beings are hesitant in doing, not only with the divine, and here I guess I'm speaking a little bit like a sociologist of religion, which I don't often, but occasionally I like to venture into that. Maybe getting a little Durkheimian here, but that. I think human beings are as scared to pursue these phases deeply, some of the more difficult phases, with each other as they are with the divine. I think we so need love, but we're so scared of it. I think that we don't know how to sit with loss. We'd rather drink and forget about it. We'd rather numb ourselves from the hurt. Oh, you know, in the West, we're into painkillers. Do you use that term over here? You take a painkiller. Well, under a lot of circumstances, painkillers are probably good. But when it comes to the heart, we also try to use painkillers. They're called antidepressants sometimes, but not all the time. Sometimes there's good rationale for that, of course. But the idea is that we have a hard time facing the pain that accompanies love, the loss. We would prefer some of the more exciting and positive dimensions of love, but we want to get rid of some of somewhere around 4, 5, and 6 are not so desirable. My suggestion is that's part of why I think it's been a more challenging task for those in religious traditions to dig deep enough into their traditions to find these phases of love as they're activated in their respective traditions, and then to be able to begin to share them. But I don't think I should go any further because I want some time for any other reactions. And I had much more material, but look, if you're at all interested, you can always read the book. But I was going to show you, anyway, because I didn't know how alive I would be once I got here, to tell you the truth. So it was hard for me to project like I would normally. Let me just open up for any comments and again, to see if... Ferdinand, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was wondering about the issue of unity of religion. It's a classical question, but what to do about Buddhism that seems like to deny personality and loving relationship that are meant to be dissolved? How would you address the issue of Buddhism within the classical Semitic religions of having a divine or
right.
not having a divine?
Right. Well, of course, it depends on which tradition you're speaking of within Buddhism. Mm-hmm. There are Buddhist traditions which are very, very...
Let's take care about that. I mean, the one.
Okay, you want to go for the. You really want to go
real,
the hardcore Buddhism. Okay. I was hoping you weren't going to say that, but even there, I think that to be able to sit with a Buddhist, there isn't any Buddhist that doesn't have some sense of compassion. This is a text that focuses on the passionate love for divinity. It also has its own conception of compassion. But Buddhism would be more the specialists in compassion. So passion for the divinity and compassion for the hearts of souls that are hurting, that are suffering. So Buddhism finds its focus really on the... on love for souls who are suffering. That's their ultimate love, and that's perfectly fine. I'm suggesting here today that there's something that we have yet to all collectively discover together once we create these bonds of human affection between traditions. And within traditions, that there's something. This is not just a sentimental like get together for kindergarten. Let's hold hands and let's dance around a fire. I mean, this is not what I'm suggesting here. I'm talking about deeply sharing what is ultimate. If we can locate that, what is ultimately meaningful to our hearts? I'm talking about this intellectually, that there's something valuable. There's something. That there's a cognitive element to this, that when we work together collectively, we will be unearthing amazing things. We will know more about what is so deeply important to us than we would have by ourselves without that connection and without that sharing. So I'm suggesting something that could emerge that's very, very deep and very, very profound. I was going to show you the Ras Mandala, but there's no time for that because your computer takes about, 45 minutes to chew up all the positive negative charges and the... Oh, very good. Ferdinando, you surprised me. It's great. Yeah, good, that's good. And maybe tomorrow afternoon he'll also surprise us. A little. That's good, now we're good. That's great. This is the ultimate vision of love for this tradition. I'm not going to say that this should be yours, right? That's not, in fact, I'm saying just the opposite. Let the gifts of this tradition emerge as something that can become valuable to you, as something that is so powerfully activated in the hearts of others. I suggest in the conclusion of my book that this becomes a marvelous symbol that goes beyond the boundaries of its own tradition, that speaks to this question of religious pluralism. There's a whole lesson of pride in this text. When the Vrajagopikas, the coward maidens, feel that they are the best women in the world because they are able to interact with Krishna, Krishna disappears. This is a great lesson. It's even a lesson repeated in another context within the same text. And it's not a very long text of only 176 verses. And for this lesson to come twice in such a short tract tells me that this is something that really is being taught here powerfully. That as soon as pride is there, God disappears. As soon as we're prideful about what it is that we believe in, what it is that we practice, what it is that we think everyone should do. Ironically, the divine disappears. And that's what happens before this gathering right here. But in the end, It shows how all of the female figures are linking arms together. And this is the way this circle forms in the story. All, and this is significant and symbolically, all of the females, and dressed differently, you see the varying kinds of dress, link arms first, while Krishna stands in the middle, and he then sees this bond of unity, this bond of love between all of the ladies, and then he then multiplies himself for each and every Vrajagopika to attend that love that they all experience together. But each one feels that she's being attended by Krishna exclusively. So it's a beautiful symbol of how inclusivism and exclusivism can work together. Too often, when we have inclusivism without exclusivism, we have a kind of, shall we say, melting pot, and like all religions are one, and what the heck, and we got that film that tries to do it, even though it contradicts itself in its findings. It denies the individuality and the beauty of the individual expression. But as soon as you have exclusivism without inclusivism, it becomes prideful and hubris. It becomes self-serving and narcissistic. We need a balance between this sense of inclusive and exclusive relationships with divinity and humankind. And I think that this image just very beautifully expresses it. And again, you'll understand it better as you know the story and the passage that speaks about it. So what I've tried to do here is to practice what I'm preaching, at least as a scholar, and that is to go deeply into these traditions, and I'm doing it in Christian traditions and in Jewish mystical traditions as well as Islamic ones, and I'm going to one day, anyway, I've got too many books already, but I'll fit that in. I'll be just late on yet another one. Why not, Ferdinando? Why not? Right? Okay, why not? So, but it needs to be done, because if religious followers are not going to do it, then perhaps scholars can stimulate that process. Go deep within the tradition. Find what is ultimately there at the very heart of the tradition, pun intended, okay, at the heart of a tradition, and then we have a basis for religious unity. That's my claim. That's my thesis for today. Are
Thank
we?
You very much.
Is that? Will that be it?
Yeah. I would also like to say that in 4:06 there will be another lecture on the religious department for those who would like to continue.
Yes. During that lecture, we will all be meditating, a silent meditation for the whole period. That way I can catch up on my rest.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be a kind of a snana dhyana. Sneha. The words are not coming to my mind. Swapna, thank you. Swapna dhyana. That's right. Or nidra dhyana, right? Yes. We'll do that. But it will be focusing maybe on the Bhagavad Gita if I can come out of that deep sleep. Yeah, exactly.
And it's called the highest yoga. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.